The Master and Margarita stands as Mikhail Bulgakov's defiant masterpiece, written secretly between 1928 and his death in 1940 during Stalin's oppressive regime. This daring novel remained unpublished until 1966-67, when it finally emerged as one of Russian literature's most celebrated works. Bulgakov belonged to the fellow travelers, writers who remained in Russia after the revolution without joining the Communist Party, insisting on creative independence despite severe persecution. Though his play has achieved enormous theatrical success, they were systematically banned, and he spent his final 13 years unable to publish. Yet, as Satan declares in the novel, manuscripts don't burn, and indeed, Bulgakov's widow preserved this remarkable work until political shifts allowed its publication. Today, the novel is celebrated for its brilliant satire, philosophical depth, and magical realism that influenced generations of writers worldwide, from Salman Rushdie to Gabriel Garcia Marquez. One hot spring afternoon at Moscow's Patriarch's Ponds, literary editor Mikhail Berlioz and poet Ivan Homeless encounter a strange foreigner. This well-dressed gentleman with mismatched eyes, one black, one green, interrupts their conversation with disturbing familiarity, insisting that Jesus historically existed and predicting Berlioz's imminent death. The stranger, who introduces himself as Professor Woland, a specialist in black magic, makes the chilling prophecy that Berlioz will be decapitated by a Russian woman, a member of the Young Communist League, and that Anushka has already bought sunflower oil, and not only bought it, but spilled it too. The literary men grow increasingly suspicious of this bizarre foreigner, who seems to know intimate details about them. When they challenge him, Woland calmly begins narrating a story about the 14th day of the spring month of Nisan, transporting them to ancient Jerusalem where Pontius Pilate interrogates Yeshua HaNozri, Jesus. The detailed account of this historical meeting, which neither Berlioz nor Ivan has written about, leaves them bewildered. When Berlioz attempts to escape this unsettling encounter by making an excuse to call authorities, Woland promises a seventh proof of the devil's existence. As Berlioz hurries toward the exit, he encounters a strange man with a chicken feather mustache, then approaches the turnstile where a warning light flashes. Suddenly, a streetcar appears, and though Berlioz stands in a safe place, his foot inexplicably slips on spilled sunflower oil. He falls onto the rails, glimpsing the horrified face of the woman conductor before the streetcar strikes him. His severed head bounces down the cobblestone slope. The promised seventh proof has been delivered. In shock, Ivan Homeless pursues the mysterious professor to the Moskva River, diving in after stripping down and leaving his clothes with a bearded stranger. When he returns, his clothes are gone, leaving him only striped underpants and a torn shirt. Determined to report the foreigner's involvement in Berlioz's death, Ivan makes his way to Gribyotov House, the writer's headquarters, in his makeshift outfit. His wild appearance and claims about a mysterious consultant who had conversations with Pontius Pilate lead to his commitment in a psychiatric hospital, diagnosed with schizophrenia aggravated by alcoholism. While Ivan languishes in the psychiatric ward, Woland and his bizarre retinue establish themselves in Moscow. They take over apartment number 50 after its tenant, Stiopa Likodeyev, director of the Variety Theater, mysteriously awakens to find Woland claiming they signed a contract the previous day for 7 performances. Despite Stiopa's confusion and lack of memory about this arrangement, Woland produces a signed contract and receipt for 10,000 rubles. Stiopa's bewilderment intensifies when 2 more bizarre characters join Woland: a lanky man with pince-nez named Koroviev, also called Faggot, and an enormous black tomcat named Behemoth, who drinks vodka and eats mushrooms with a fork. A fourth visitor emerges from the mirror, a red-haired man with fangs called Azazello. This infernal retinue declares Stiopa superfluous in his own apartment and magically transports him to Yalta, nearly 1,200 miles from Moscow. The demonic visitors quickly spread chaos throughout Moscow. They expose the greed of Nikanor Ivanovich Basai, chairman of the Tenants Association, by planting foreign currency in his apartment and having him arrested. At the Variety Theater, they stage a black magic seance where they distribute fashionable women's clothing to the audience, only to have the garments disappear later, leaving women running through Moscow streets in their underwear. During this performance, they publicly humiliate Arkady Apollinovich Semplyarov, exposing his affair with actress Melitza Pokobakko. The financial manager Rimsky and house manager Varanuka attempt to investigate Wolin's credentials, only to encounter supernatural terror. Varanuka is beaten by Azazello and a naked witch named Hela, then temporarily transformed into a vampire. Rimsky barely escapes with his life after witnessing Varanuka's transformation, his hair turning completely white from terror. As Moscow descends into chaos, with people passing off worthless items as money and reports of flying women and talking cats, investigators struggle to make sense of these supernatural occurrences. They repeatedly search apartment number 50, finding evidence of occupation, but never catching its mysterious residents. In the psychiatric hospital, Ivan Bezdomny meets a fellow patient who introduces himself simply as the Master. This mysterious man with anxious eyes and dark hair reveals he was once a historian who won 100,000 rubles in a lottery, allowing him to quit his museum job and rent a basement apartment near Arbat to write a novel about Pontius Pilate. The Master describes how, while walking along Tverskaya Street one day, he noticed a woman carrying loathsome, disturbing yellow flowers, who gave him a troubled look of extraordinary loneliness. Following her, they began a conversation about the flowers. He admitted disliking them, preferring roses instead. She threw the yellow flowers away, and soon they were walking arm in arm. "Love caught us suddenly," the Master tells Ivan, "leaped at us like a murderer appearing from out of nowhere in an alley, and struck us both down at once, like lightning, like a Finnish knife." This mysterious woman became his secret wife, visiting him daily in his basement apartment. She embraced his novel completely, reading what he'd written, dusting his books, and predicting his fame. She began calling him Master, and said the novel was her life. But when the Master attempted to publish his novel, he faced devastating criticism. Critics Araman, Lavrovich, and especially Latunsky published scathing articles attacking him for Pilatism and attempting to smuggle an apology for Jesus Christ into print. Falling into profound depression, the Master burned his novel in the stove. When his lover returned unexpectedly, she desperately tried to save the charred pages, weeping uncontrollably. She promised to leave her husband and return to him forever the next morning, but those were her last words to him. The Master then wandered the streets in despair until eventually finding himself in the psychiatric hospital where he'd been for 4 months. He tells Ivan he can no longer recall his novel without a shudder, and that Ivan's acquaintance from Patriarch's Ponds could have done it far better. The Master's beloved is revealed as Margarita Nikolaevna, a beautiful, intelligent 30-year-old woman married to a prominent specialist. Despite their comfortable life in an excellent house surrounded by a garden near Arbat Square, Margarita has known no happiness since the Master's disappearance. She torments herself with regret for leaving him that fateful night, comparing herself to Matthew Levi, who arrived too late to save Yeshua. One Friday, after her husband leaves on a business trip, Margarita encounters a strange red-haired man named Azazello, who quotes from the Master's manuscript and reveals he knows her thoughts. When he hints she might learn something about the Master, she eagerly agrees to visit a mysterious foreigner. Azazello gives her a golden box containing a mysterious cream, which she accepts despite her misgivings, declaring she would go to the devil himself to find the Master. Alone in her bedroom, Margarita applies the yellowish cream to her face and is astonished to see her reflection transformed. Her eyebrows thickened, eyes turned green, and all signs of aging vanished. Applying it to her entire body, she discovers she can levitate. Beyond physical changes, she feels an effervescent joy, millions of stinging bubbles coursing through her body, freeing her from everything. Understanding she's leaving her former life forever, Margarita writes a farewell note to her husband. "I am leaving you forever. I have become a witch from all the trials and tribulations that befell me." Following Azazello's instructions, she mounts a broom that flies into her room and soars out the window, invisible to all but those she chooses to reveal herself to. Soaring through Moscow, Margarita indulges her newfound powers by wreaking havoc in critic Latunsky's apartment, flooding it, smashing his piano, and destroying his mirrors with a hammer. Later, she flies over forests and rivers until reaching a moonlit riverbank where she's welcomed by frogs playing music, mermaids, and witches before being transported back to Moscow. Margarita arrives at apartment number 50, now magically expanded into an impossibly vast space with marble columns stretching endlessly upward and fountains flowing with champagne. There she encounters Woland himself, Satan in mortal form, reclining on an ornate bed, his appearance both mesmerizing and unsettling, with one eye gleaming like molten gold and the other black as the depths of the universe. Woland addresses her as Queen Margot and demonstrates his remarkable crystal globe, a supernatural device showing real-time events unfolding across the world, from intimate moments to grand catastrophes. As midnight approaches, Margarita assumes her role as hostess of Satan's grand ball. Following an ancient ritual, she is bathed in blood by Hela and crowned with a heavy diamond diadem that burns into her flesh. The guests emerge one by one from a massive fireplace below, an endless procession of history's most notorious figures. Each must be personally greeted by Margarita, who endures their kisses while wearing nothing but the blood and crown, a royal chain weighing heavily on her hand. The parade of damned souls includes poisoners, murderers, traitors, and criminals of every variety. Notable figures emerge throughout the night: Caligula with his mad eyes, the Empress Messalina, known for her legendary debauchery, corrupt kings, fallen dukes, famous suicides, and merciless executioners. Each guest kisses Margarita's knee, which swells painfully from the endless genuflections, while her arm aches from the weight of the ceremonial chain. The parade of damned souls includes poisoners, murderers, traitors, and criminals of every variety. Notable figures emerge throughout the night: Caligula with his mad eyes, the Empress Messalina, known for her legendary debauchery, corrupt kings, fallen dukes, famous suicides, and merciless executioners. Each guest kisses Margarita's knee, which swells painfully from the endless genuflections, while her arm aches from the weight of the ceremonial chain. Among this grotesque assemblage appears Frida, a particularly tragic figure who smothered her illegitimate infant in the woods with a handkerchief, a crime for which she is eternally tormented by having that same handkerchief appear on her nightstand each morning. When Frida desperately begs Margarita for mercy, Margarita, moved by compassion, advises her to get drunk today and don't think of anything. This moment of kindness causes Koroviev to hurriedly usher Frida along, preventing a disruption in the carefully orchestrated procession. At the stroke of midnight, an eerie silence descends as Woland makes his grand appearance, paradoxically dressed in shabby attire and leaning on a sword that seems both ancient and powerful. In a macabre ceremony, Azazello presents him with the severed head of Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz, the literary critic who had denied the existence of Jesus and the devil. Woland addresses the head with savage irony, mocking its former owner's materialistic theories about death leading to absolute non-existence. With a theatrical flourish, he transforms the head into a grotesque drinking vessel, a skull goblet with gleaming emerald eyes. When the ball concludes, Woland offers Margarita her reward for serving as hostess. Instead of requesting something for herself, she remembers Frida's suffering and asks that the woman be freed from her eternal torment with the handkerchief. Though Wolin scorns this display of mercy as misguided, he permits Margarita herself to grant Frida's pardon, a test of her character. Only after this act of selflessness does Margarita make her true desire known, the return of her beloved master from the psychiatric hospital where he has been confined. Throughout the novel, we return repeatedly to the story of Pontius Pilate and Yeshua HaNazri, the narrative from the master's burned manuscript. This story within a story reveals Pilate's encounter with Yeshua, whom he finds strangely compelling despite his duty to condemn him. Yeshua is portrayed not as a divine figure, but as a philosophical wanderer who believes all men are good and speaks truth regardless of consequences. During their interrogation, Pilate is struck by Yeshua's insight into his terrible headache and his ability to read Pilate's thoughts. Though tempted to save this unusual prisoner, Pilate ultimately condemns him to execution after the high priest Caiaphas insists on releasing the murderer Bar-Rabban instead, as is the Passover custom. As Yeshua is crucified on Bald Mountain alongside two thieves, a storm approaches from the west. Matthew Levi, Yeshua's devoted follower, watches in despair, cursing God for his injustice. When the executioners mercifully pierce Yeshua's heart after offering him water, Levi cuts down the bodies and disappears with Yeshua's remains before the deluge completely engulfs the hill. Later, we learn that Pilate arranged the murder of Yehuda of Kerioth, Judas, who had betrayed Yeshua for 30 tetradrachmas. Through his chief of secret service, Afranius, Pilate orchestrates Yehuda's stabbing in the olive grove of Gethsemane, where he had gone to meet a woman named Nisa. The assassins return Yehuda's money to the high priest's palace with a note, "Take back the accursed money." For 2,000 years, Pilate is condemned to sit on a rocky mountaintop during full moons, tormented by insomnia, with his faithful dog Banga beside him. He dreams of climbing a path of moonlight to speak with Yeshua, feeling he didn't say everything he wanted to during their meeting. Pilate hates his immortality and fame, wishing to exchange his fate with the ragged wanderer Matthew Levi. When Wolin summons the master and Margarita to his presence in the candlelit apartment, he inquires about the master's novel with peculiar interest. The master, still wearing his asylum clothing, reluctantly explains his work, a historical novel about Pontius Pilate's fateful encounter with Yeshua HaNozri. With pain in his voice, he confesses to burning the manuscript in a moment of despair during the winter, watching the pages curl and blacken in his stove. Wolin's response, "Manuscripts don't burn," emerges as one of literature's most powerful declarations of artistic immortality. With theatrical flourish, Behemoth produces the intact manuscript from seemingly nowhere, its pages pristine despite their supposed destruction. This profound statement becomes the novel's central metaphor for the endurance of art and truth despite attempts to suppress them. In Soviet Russia, where writers faced persecution, imprisonment, and death, the phrase carried particular resonance. Just as Bulgakov's own novel survived, despite the author's persecution, having been hidden, rewritten from memory, and preserved through oral recitation, the master's novel about Pilate persists beyond its physical destruction. The statement suggests that genuine artistic creation exists in a realm beyond the material world, immune to fire, censorship, or political pressure. When Margarita, overcome with joy at recovering the manuscript, asks Wolin to return them to their basement apartment, the master protests with bitter resignation that someone else now occupies their former sanctuary. Wolin, maintaining his role as supernatural arbiter of justice, summons Aloisi Mogarich, the opportunistic informer who wrote a denunciation of the master to steal his apartment. In a scene mixing comedy with vengeance, Azazello unceremoniously ejects Mogarich through the window. Koroviev, with bureaucratic precision, magically erases all official records of Mogarich's residency, the hospital records, the landlord's registry book, and other documentary evidence of the betrayal. The restoration of their home comes complete with Margarita's possessions, each item carrying deep symbolic weight. the manuscript with its telltale charred edges, a dried rose from their courtship, a photograph preserving happier times, and her savings bank book, practical proof of their restored life together. These objects represent not just material possessions, but the reconstruction of their shared past and identity. In their restored basement apartment, Margarita weeps with joy while caressing the manuscript's pages. Her tears fall on the charred edges as she reads the novel's opening line. The darkness which had come from the Mediterranean shrouded the city hated by the procurator. The passage connects the Moscow narrative to the Jerusalem chapters, suggesting that, like the manuscript itself, truth and artistic vision persist across time and space, defying both physical destruction and political repression. As Moscow descends into chaos, with the fires set by Wolin's retinue consuming both apartment number 50 and the prestigious Griboyedov house, the master and Margarita receive their final summons. The moment arrives through Azazello, who brings them a special vintage, the same Falernian wine that once passed the lips of Pontius Pilate in ancient Judea. This wine serves as both poison and transformation, first ending their mortal lives before resurrecting them in ethereal forms, freed from earthly constraints and suffering. On the Vorobyev Hills, as the sun paints Moscow's sky in brilliant crimsons and golds, they gather with Woland and his supernatural entourage for their departure. The master makes one final, poignant visit to Ivan Bezdomny in the clinic, passing the torch of storytelling to his successor. Write the continuation, he urges, entrusting Ivan with the sacred task of preserving and extending Pilate's tale. Margarita, too, bids farewell to Ivan, bestowing a kiss and acknowledging him as my disciple, marking him as the inheritor of their literary and spiritual legacy. Their flight from Moscow reveals the true nature of Wolin's companions, stripping away their mundane disguises. Korovyev's transformation is particularly striking. Gone is the checkered-suited translator, replaced by a majestic purple knight adorned with a golden chain, his demeanor now grave and dignified. Behemoth sheds his feline form to become a graceful youth, the perfect embodiment of a demon page whose wit and humor transcend earthly understanding. Azazello's transformation is perhaps the most dramatic. His artificial imperfections vanish to reveal his true essence as the demon of the waterless desert, a being of terrible beauty and deadly precision. Their journey leads them to a desolate mountaintop where they encounter the tragic figure of Pontius Pilate, trapped in eternal torment. For 2,000 years, 12,000 moons, he has sat motionless with his faithful dog, staring unseeing at the moon, punishment for his momentary cowardice in condemning Yeshua. Margarita, moved by compassion, questions the severity of his sentence. Her cry for his release, "Let him go," carries such power that it literally shakes the mountain, sending stones crashing down its face. In this climactic moment, Wolin turns to the master, indicating that the time has come to conclude his novel with a single redemptive phrase. The master's words ring out across the centuries. "You are free! You are free! He waits for you!" As he speaks, the very landscape transforms. The harsh mountains dissolve to reveal a magnificent city, gleaming with ancient idols and a paradise-like garden. Pilate's faithful dog bounds ahead onto the moonlit path, leading his master toward long-awaited peace. After 2 millennia of solitude and regret, Pilate finally receives his pardon, released from the prison of his own conscience to seek the forgiveness he has craved for so long. This scene of redemption and release serves as a powerful culmination of the novel's themes of courage, forgiveness, and the eternal nature of truth and justice. The parallel between Pilate's freedom and the master and Margarita's own release from earthly suffering underscores the novel's message about the transformative power of love and the possibility of redemption, no matter how long the wait. Years after Wolin's departure from Moscow, the city has largely forgotten the strange events, dismissing them as mass hypnosis or criminal trickery. Those affected by his visit see changes in their lives. Bengalski recovers but resigns from the Variety Theater. Varenuka becomes known for his courtesy. Stiocha Likadeev is transferred to Rostov. Rimsky retires to work at a children's puppet theater. And Alois Mogaryk becomes the Variety Theater's financial manager. Yet, not everyone has forgotten. Every spring during the full moon, Professor Ivan Nikolaevich Ponarev, formerly the poet Homeless, visits the Patriarch's Ponds, sitting on the same bench where Berlioz met his end. Though cured of his supposed mental illness, Ivan remains powerless against the spring full moon's pull. After these disturbing outings, Ivan returns home ill. His wife administers injections that grant him blissful dreams instead of nightmares about the crucifixion. In these dreams, he sees Pontius Pilate walking toward the moon with Yeshua, begging reassurance that the execution never happened. Ivan also sees the Master and Margarita, with the Master identified as his nocturnal visitor, number 118. When Ivan asks if that was how it ended, the Master confirms it was, while Margarita kisses Ivan's forehead, promising all will be as it should. The Master and Margarita ultimately transcends its historical context to become a universal meditation on the nature of good and evil, the power of love, and the enduring significance of art. Through the parallel narratives of Moscow and Jerusalem, Bulgakov suggests that truth exists beyond official narratives, that love can transcend death, and that authentic art, like manuscripts that don't burn, will outlast all attempts at suppression. The novel itself stands as proof of this principle, having survived decades of censorship to emerge as one of the 20th century's greatest literary achievements.